I'd like to call this meeting to order. This is the State Senate Affairs Committee meeting. Today is February 16th, 2012. The time is about 9:04 in the morning. Today we have three bills before us. We'll also be hearing a presentation by the Foraker Group on Alaska's nonprofit economy. First bill is Senate Bill 121, which would provide public employees with a choice in retirement systems. Second is Senate Bill 179, which would create a new statewide alert system to help find vulnerable missing adults. The third is Senate Bill 129, which would allow child care centers to be located in office buildings owned or leased by the state of Alaska. It's my hope that we can move at least the first two bills and have a discussion. I know there were some questions on the third one. We'll begin with Senate Bill 121. This is our sixth hearing on the bill. At our last meeting, we adopted two amendments. The most significant of these would help to ensure that the health care costs of the new defined benefit tier never exceed those of the existing defined contributions program. I believe we've finally achieved the sponsor's goal of crafting a retirement system that will save the state and municipalities money while providing teachers, police officers, firefighters, and other public employees with retirement benefits they can count on. We have Senator Egan with us. I know he's got a Finance Committee hearing that he's waiting to get to, and Jesse Keel, I believe, is also here. And if you could just briefly come forward and put yourself on the record, give us any final remarks that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Senator Dennis Egan. I represent District B, the Juneau area. And I personally want to thank all of you for all the time and work you put into this piece of legislation, Senate Bill 121. I know you've had six hearings in three cities and innumerable conversations with different folks around the state and, you know, public servants, not only in state but municipal government as well, want the choice to earn a pension and retire in Alaska. Experts talked about the benefits of both systems, defined benefits and defined contributions, and the bill changed a lot. It now saves the state, at the outset, $49 million in the first 5 years. It's now cost neutral long term. It shares the risk between employees and employers, and it adds nothing, not one red cent, to the unfunded liabilities from the past. Senate Bill 121 lets new hires who serve our state and our cities, who teach our kids and respond to our times of need, choose between a portable account to save for retirement or a monthly pension check. Personal accounts are great for recruiting researchers, military spouses, or corporate retirees to state and local government. And pensions are great for keeping those who spend their lives teaching our children, patrolling our prisons, and managing our fisheries. To make the new system cost neutral, employees will share the risk of health costs rising in the future. That's a risk worth taking, and it's fair to Alaskans, and state and municipal employees are willing to take that risk as well. Mr. Chair, I hope you will move the bill forward, and again, on behalf of myself and my staff, thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you, Senator Egan. And I know the department, we've asked them to prepare a fiscal note. They do not have one. But my calculations show, similar to your calculations, that this will save the state $49 million over 5 years. That's the estimate from the administration. But then over the 30-year time frame, it appears that it could save the state tens of millions additional more, if not hundreds of millions additional more. Is that your understanding as well?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you. And that was the goal of the bill, was to try to get this revenue neutral or to save money, and it appears that we have achieved that. So thank you for your hard work.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and again, for the committee and all your indulgence. And I have a meeting in finance right now, but my staff, Jesse Keel, who is the expert on Senate Bill 121, is here to answer questions.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I know the bill has a further referral to Finance Committee, where I'm sure we'll get a rigorous review there. Any questions from the committee members? Okay, seeing none, Do we have a motion to move Senate Bill 121, version R, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and two attached fiscal notes, one for $769,000 in FY13 to help the Department of Administration get the system up and running, and one from the Department of Revenue for $593,000 in fiscal year 2013 to cover the additional retirement board management fees? An additional fiscal note from the Department of Administration will be forthcoming.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to make that motion for you. I'd like to speak to the department if we have just
Absolutely. Could we get the department to come forward?
Welcome. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration.
Well, thank you for joining us. You heard the sponsor say that this is now revenue neutral, which was the goal of, I think, of all of ours, was to get to that point. I don't think it really matters to us if it's defined benefit or defined contribution. It's a matter of cost to the state. Do you agree with the sponsor's statement?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the goal is to make it cost neutral to employers in terms of normal cost. In terms of past service costs, which is where any unfunded liability comes from, no defined benefit bill can guarantee that. And for that reason, the administration continues to oppose the SB 121. And I think it bears reflecting a little bit on the history of this bill. When it was first introduced, it was born with an unfunded liability, $124 million unfunded liability. And the reason for that unfunded liability is that it guaranteed one-for-one service credit for current DCR members who transfer into the DB system, and it had the general fund restore account balances. Because of the investment losses in those DCR balances in 2009, there wasn't enough funds in them to create a one-for-one service credit. So it was born with an unfunded liability. That's what happens in defined benefit plans. When there are investment losses, unfunded liabilities are created. The next thing that happened is a fiscal note was drafted, and it was incorrect because the actuary didn't understand how the bill worked. And I'll own some complicity in that. I didn't understand it either. Does that sound familiar? We had the exact same experience in our regular DB plans. The actuaries got something wrong. Unfunded liability was created. The next thing that happened after that is we looked at the health care costs, which are increasing under the adopted actuarial assumptions for health care over the course of the next decades. And it showed continued costs to employers in years 20 to 30 that were going to cost the state more. Again, that's what happens in defined benefit plans, is costs increase more than projected, and the state ends up having to own that. The way that was resolved was actually last week, Senator Meyer, where a new amendment was put in and the costs were shifted to the retirees. But again, this is what happens. We've had three issues now: investment loss, mistake, healthcare cost growth, in the very short life of this bill, illustrating what happens in a defined benefit plan. If that, all of those three things can happen in the space of months, Mr. Chair, imagine what will happen when we turn this on and make these promises for decades. Not months, 40, 50, 60 years. We put a 20-year-old in 2013. They will retire in the 2050s, 2060s. Over that time period, we can have investment loss. Over that time period, we can have healthcare cost growth that is out of line with our projections. Over that time, we can have mistakes, other things. People could end up living longer. It's for these reasons that the administration strongly opposes enactment of this bill.
Any further questions?
No, I appreciate the comments, and normally we can't get a position from the administration on bills, so this is a little unusual, but it's good to know your position, and appreciate the explanation. It certainly is hard to predict the future and what the health care costs may be or won't be, so I understand the concern. Thank you.
And I would just add that's why we do fiscal notes, is to try to, as accurately as possible, predict what will happen. You fired an actuary who's on a retainer for $700,000, I believe, and that actuary has had roughly a year to work on this fiscal note. They've come out with their latest fiscal note, which makes assumptions and comes up with their best estimate based on all the facts as to what will happen. And I know when they did this, they hoped to learn from the mistakes of the past, where in the past they assumed that healthcare costs would increase by only 3% a year, and they actually increased by 10% a year. We're assuming healthcare costs are going to increase 10% a year for the next 30 years, which I think actually for the next probably even longer than that, which I think is completely unreasonable, because if that's the case, then in 30 years we're paying $150,000, $160,000 per employee for health care benefits. So we're making assumptions which I think, based on the past experience, which I think are completely unreasonable, but these are the assumptions that your experts came forward with. We're assuming worst case scenario. You're going to continue to increase health insurance at 10% a year. You're going to continue to have employees, the state, paying $150,000 per employee per year for health care costs. Again, an assumption which I think is completely unreasonable. I think our entire economy collapses on that. But that's the assumption that we're using as we go forward on this. And we've put in a provision that says the costs of the defined benefit program cannot exceed 95% of the costs of the current program. So I think we've developed a system here that's going to save the state hundreds of millions of dollars. We've asked you for an updated fiscal note. We've got a 90-day session. We typically have fiscal notes turned around within days. When we do our all tax bills, we typically have fiscal notes billions and billions of dollars turned around in days. With this, for some reason, with this bill, we've waited months for fiscal notes. Now we've waited another week, and we still don't have a fiscal note. So these are your assumptions. You're using your experts' assumptions, your department's assumptions. We have concluded this bill will save hundreds of millions of dollars. So I'll just leave it at that. Are there any other questions by the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd love to have a chance to get a word in edgewise. I know you're going to pass the bill. But I think, Mr. Chair, your assumptions are, with respect, mistaken in a number of respects. Number one, the actuary has had a week.
These are not my assumptions. These are your assumptions.
Mr. Chair, with respect.
Tell me what assumptions your department and your experts are making that are incorrect.
The actuary has had a week to work on this version of the bill. This version of the bill, for the benefit of the committee, what it does to solve the health care cost growth problem is it puts it on the backs of successive five-year generations of retirees. Once you retire, the amount that you pay, you contribute to the premium of the health care plan, is fixed. If the actuary's assumption that informs that premium share rate is incorrect, that retiree doesn't bear the brunt of that. The next generation of retirees bear the brunt of that. If that assumption ends up being incorrect, the next generation. What you end up having is a cascading series of passing along the buck to the next generation of retirees. That's very complicated. I'm not aware of any plan in the world that does it like that. Secondly, 10% cost growth assumption. Our experience has been 9%, Mr. Chair, and that's what I testified to at the last hearing. I don't know where you got 10%. It certainly wasn't from me, and it wasn't from any publication of the Arm Board. The Arm Board has adopted a health care cost growth assumption that trends down over time. And I believe I testified at the last session that at the end of a century, it will get down to something like 5%. For the next 50 or so years, it will be something less than 6%. Those are the assumptions that the Arm Board has adopted. Those are the assumptions that inform the actuarial work that has been put forward to date on this bill. And in closing, Mr. Chair, I want to just talk about the experience a bit of the Alaska DB plan. We had inappropriate actuarial vetting from 1995 to 2003. This came to the legislature's attention, and as a result, SB 141 was passed, closing the defined benefit plan. One of the themes of that legislation is that we need to have more actuarial oversight of how we do defined benefit. We now have a fiscal notes just for retirement systems. It requires actuarial work to be completed before a bill is reported to the Rules Committee. We have a secondary actuary that looks over the shoulder of the primary actuary before any actuarial results are reported to the ARM board. Full actuarial vetting. That's what the legislature has required of us. We do full actuarial vetting. And Mr. Chair, with respect, 1 week of actuarial review of the current version of this bill, I would submit, is not full actuarial vetting. And I would further submit, Mr. Chair, that the people of Alaska, who are going to bear the brunt of the promises that this bill makes, that successive generations of Alaskans, our children and grandchildren, are entitled to full actuarial vetting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhill. You've had 1 year to have this fully actuarial vetted. You have an actuary on contract who's being paid by the people of Alaska over $700,000. Is that accurate? And we get fiscal notes turned around in days in this building. We get fiscal notes on oil tax bills that are billions and billions of dollars projected over decades, turned around in days. You have an outside company at your disposal whose expertise is in this area, and 1 week is plenty of time. So I appreciate your comments. I'd like to call up the bill's sponsor and get any further comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Egan. I apologize the senator had to be in the Finance Committee this morning. If I may, Mr. Chairman,
please.
The sponsor, let me echo the sponsor's gratitude for the work this committee has put in. A few things that we heard this morning I'd like to comment on Senator Egan's behalf. The first would be that I apologize if in a private conversation I gave you the impression that this bill guarantees the new tier won't exceed 95% of the current DC system. It will not exceed the normal cost of the new DC system. There is not a 95% clause in the amendment that the committee put in place. I think it is reasonable to expect that on a normal cost basis, this bill will, with its 5-year adjustments and the requirement that in year 5 you don't exceed, it will save some money. I don't know that I can defend 95% to you in committee. So I apologize if I gave you a mistaken impression during a conversation earlier. I'd also like to note that when a retiree under this new DB tier retires, the amount they pay for their health insurance is not fixed. That was not an entirely accurate statement a few minutes ago. The percentage of the premium is fixed. As premiums rise or fall, to be honest, healthcare premiums don't fall. As premiums rise more quickly or more slowly, the percentage the retiree pays and the percentage paid by the system would fix once a person retires. While we're just doing the corrections, the statutory requirement that we have an actuarial analysis of our retirement systems long precedes the 2005 enactment of the defined contribution system. It would also be worth noting again, Mr. Chairman, as the sponsor did in earlier comments, that all of the Senate Bill 141 from 2005 safeguards for our defined benefit systems remain in place. This bill doesn't alter any of them. There will be a second actuary to check the first. There will be an ARM board with a certain number of disinterested members, and I apologize that in a previous testimony for this committee I got the number wrong, but with disinterested members and with financial expertise, and a requirement that under no circumstance may employers pay less than the normal cost. it's worth noting as well that the normal cost is the operator for keeping the new tier cost neutral as healthcare costs are projected to rise. It is the pre-funding cost of the defined benefit system that we're keeping not to exceed the cost of the defined contribution system. And so I take issue a little bit with the notion that the cost is shifted exclusively to future generations of retirees. It is the pre-funding that is held with the adjustments to a group of retirees' premium share. It's in fact arguable that the first batch of retirees actually may pay a little more for future retirees' benefits. But Mr. Chairman, really what you see in this health care cost adjustment is pooling of risk and moving of that risk to employees. Pooled and shared risk is a hybrid feature of the new tier that is before you today. It's real risk. I'm not going to suggest to the committee that that anything is gold-plated or that anybody has it made here. If healthcare costs go up faster than you and I think they will, it becomes potentially quite burdensome to future retirees. Mr. Chairman, that's a risk that Alaska's public servants are willing to take in exchange for the opportunity to choose a defined benefit system. I thank you for the opportunity to bring those points forward, Mr. Chairman.
Jesse, if you could talk a little bit about how the fiscal note process has worked, how long have you waited for fiscal notes, what sort of assumptions were used by the administration to create the fiscal note, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chairman, the time frames on the actuaries' analyses have varied with different versions of the bill. As you know, of course, it was just last week that the amendment for the healthcare cost share came in, and I had an additional phone call, part of which was a teleconference with Mr. Barnhill with the actuary yesterday. I believe that they are proceeding apace. I would always like all my things right now, please, but I think that the fiscal note will be I believe the administration will have a fiscal note with the actuarial analysis in time to take up the bill in the Finance Committee if this committee sees fit to move this bill today. The legislature will have full information before it. I appreciate the willingness of Mr. Barnhill and, quite frankly, a divergence from practice of some past administrations to make the actuary available to the sponsor of this bill. That has been a good step and much appreciated by Senator Egan. Mr. Chairman, I believe that the actuarial analysis and codified in the fiscal note will be before the legislature timely.
All right. Any further questions? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, just comment, I'll be happy to make the motion to move this bill. I have to put on my state affairs hat. This is not the Finance Committee hat. And what is the best state policy? What is the best policy for the state of Alaska? And I truly think letting the employees have a choice between a defined benefit and a defined contribution is the best policy. And it's the best way to attract employees, best way to keep and retain our employees. Now, whether or not we can afford that, I think that's a question for the Finance Committee, where they then will evaluate the next 30 years where our revenue is going to come from, and it's probably going to continue to come from 90% from oil. That's not our decision here. That's not something that we're going to think about. But I have had many military guys or retirees after 20 years who have a defined benefit actually want a defined contribution. I've had folks who say, hey, we don't trust ourselves in investing. We don't want to have to invest ourselves. So they don't want the defined contribution. They want a defined benefit. So I've heard both sides, and I agree with both sides. And I think if we were to look at states in the lower 48, most have a hybrid type system. I think we're unique up here, having just a defined contribution system. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if you're ready for a motion.
Yes, I am.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill 121 with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Can I just make a friendly suggestion? Senate Bill 121 version R is amended from committee with individual recommendations, two attached fiscal notes, and an additional fiscal note from Department of Administration forthcoming.
Okay. Whatever you just
just so we get it technically correct. Is there any objection to moving the bill? Okay, and you're right. The bill does have a long way to go. This is the first committee of referral. If there's no objection, the bill is moved.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, we'll now move on to Senate Bill 179, which would create a new statewide alert system to help find vulnerable missing adults. Last week, we heard testimony in support of the bill from the Alaska State Troopers, Alaska Association of Retired People, Alaska Commission on Aging, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and several Alzheimer's associations, among others. I'm unaware of any negative testimony that was received, and my office has not received any proposed amendments. The bill has 3-0 fiscal notes, two from the Department of Public Safety and one from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Does the bill sponsor have anything final to add before we consider the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Betty Davis, and I represent East Anchorage. And I want to say to you, I'm glad that you were able to bring this back in a timely manner. I think it's a bill that would be quite helpful to our citizens in the state, and looking forward for you to pass it out of the committee today if possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Davis. Any final questions or from the committee members? Okay, seeing none, we've got a few members online from the Department of Public Safety and from the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Department. Any questions for those members? Okay, seeing none, is it the will of the committee to move Senate Bill 179 version A with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes?
Be happy to, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. Just take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back on the record, and we'll now go to Senate Bill 129, which would allow child care centers to be located in office buildings owned or leased by the state of Alaska. Could we get the bill sponsor to come forward? Welcome to the committee. You put yourself on the record, Genevieve.
Yes, for the record, Genevieve 126, staff to Senator McGuire. She is on the morning plane, so I'm sorry she can't be here, but she'll be here soon, later today.
Thank you. I know the committee had some questions and some concerns last week, and I guess have you had an opportunity to look into some of those, and
yes.
If the committee members have any questions?
Yeah, and Vern Jones is here from General Services. If there are any additional questions, I think we had them all answered, but if there's anything else, I'm here.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Meyer.
We have Mr. Jones here.
Oh, great. Mr. Jones, if you come forward, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Vern Jones. I'm the state's chief procurement officer.
Welcome to the committee. I think Senator Meyer had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Jones, I think if I recall the comments on this bill, and I certainly support the concept of this because having had children here in Juneau, finding daycare is very difficult. In fact, I think we had to drive all the way out to the valley in order to find daycare at the Juneau Christian Church. So having it here downtown next to the Capitol is great. But I think we heard that it wasn't going to cost the state any money, and I'm having a little trouble with that concept because it seems like whenever the state has vacant property, we could be leasing that out and be bringing in revenues. So would you agree with that concept that it there is some opportunity costs there to the state by allowing all the state buildings to be open and available to daycare services? And then I guess my other question would be, is this fair to the small business daycare centers who have invested their money and perhaps do have to charge more because, you know, they do have to pay for their space and the utilities and overhead costs?
Thank you, Senator Meyer, through the chair. It's probably not accurate to say that there would be no cost should the state implement child care centers in its facilities or in leased facilities. It's more accurate to say it's not possible for us to choose a number at present because of all the unknowns we have. We have an indeterminate fiscal note. The reason why that's difficult to predict is because the bill itself is permissive, so there's no specific requirement for us to build daycare centers into our existing facilities. There is a section in this bill, though, that would require us to put in daycare centers if we acquire or build new buildings that house house more than 250 employees. And the analysis on our fiscal note, I had just through some approximations estimated costs of what it would have cost us to put in daycare centers for the last three buildings that we acquired. I see for the Atwood building we're estimated a little over $2 million. That's roughly 10% of the cost, the purchase price of that building. The difficulty, though, in picking a number is how many new buildings are we going to acquire? We don't acquire buildings that often. Furthermore, these are just the additional costs of installing the daycare center. We're assuming that part of our assumption here is that we'll spend the money to put the daycare center in, but we're going to charge rent to that daycare provider like we would any other tenant in our buildings. So we won't take a loss as far as the operation of the facility. Daycare provider would be paying us rent. They would be charging the clients a fee, so the state would be sort of neutral in that. But then you have the issue of what about these construction costs? Construction costs are higher for something like a daycare center. It's very specialized. And in addition to that, I think what you're getting at, Senator Meyer, is what about the opportunity cost? We typically operate a state facility and charge a tenant maintenance and operating costs and some depreciation is factored in, but that's typically substantially less than a market rate. The Atwood building is probably the rate we charge in the Atwood building is probably about half of what that building could get in rents on the open market, likewise with the state office building. So also difficult to factor in, but what you'd have is a situation where an agency, you know, you would displace an agency, or you would have an agency lease space on the open market who would otherwise be in a building, and they would be paying more. But again, that's very difficult for us to predict, you know, how many of these are going to be, how many buildings will be purchased or acquired or built. And, you know, again, these are all approximations. So I hope that answered your question, Senator.
I think it does, Mr. Chairman, and obviously too, it's an employee benefit, and there's always a cost with any employee benefits. But you justify those employee benefits with employee retention, employee morale, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Hard to measure financially, but there is a reward back to the state for that. I think you touched on the area that concerns me, is that we are leasing a lot of space all over in Anchorage, all over here in Juneau, and you know, would we be saving more money to the state of Alaska if we, instead of paying whatever we're paying for that space, brought those people into the buildings that we already own, instead of providing a daycare? And I guess that's just a question that we'll have to wrestle with, and I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? I thought we heard testimony too that the daycare over here in the Thomas Stewart building, we actually picked up the custodial costs and the utility costs as well. And maybe that's not the plan for future daycare centers in the state buildings.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I'm not sure exactly how that works. It's of course a different branch than I work in, and we didn't make those arrangements, but like I said, we would likely try and recoup our costs and charge the provider what we would, so that at least our facilities budget would not be inflated on an operating basis. The capital expense of building out a daycare would be another story that we're not sure how that would work. Your other question, Senator, was competition with the private sector. I'm not sure in a scenario like I've described that there would be undue favoritism to a daycare provider if we were to install a child care facility in a state office. We would charge them rent. It would be an advantage, I think, in that we typically charge less than a market rent, unless we were to decide to charge market rates instead of our normal facility rates that we do with other state agencies. We have some very strict rules on chargeback and how we establish chargeback rates. The committee might be interested to know that we typically don't keep track of headcounts, how many employees we have in our facilities. We, in general services, we're largely concerned with the square footage and how we manage a building, and we don't always keep track of how many people we have. But because of an initiative that's underway now and to try and make our office space usage more efficient, we do have some headcounts, and we've learned that only two of our facilities have over 250 employees in them currently, and that's the state office building, the Atwood building, although we have four leased facilities, one in Juneau and three in Anchorage, that have over 250 people in them currently. Like I said, we're undergoing an efficiency analysis now. We hope to have higher density. That's our goal, to have higher density in state-owned facilities in future, so that could change.
All right. Senator Giesel, did you have a question?
I did. Just for clarification, you said that you charge, I wrote down half, approximately half the fair market value for the space. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, That's about what it works out to, is what we charge state agencies. There are some very strict federal rules that we have to follow in establishing what we charge in our state-owned buildings, and it's basically how much it costs us to operate them and maintain them, and depreciation. Now, that winds up generally being substantially less than a market rate if you were to go out and lease space. So, it's not always half. It just depends on the acquisition price and the maintenance costs and a number of factors. But I know the Atwood building is roughly half of probably what, and the state office building, our two largest buildings, of what we could get equivalent space for in the open market.
Follow up?
Yes. So this, according to the bill, would be a private company that would be leasing the space. And so would they, I guess I would question whether they qualify for half the fair market value lease price.
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, my understanding is that we are allowed to charge them the same amount under federal guidelines as we do our other tenants in the building, but I am unsure whether we're also allowed to charge a higher rate. I think we are allowed to charge a market rate to a non-state entity, but I would have to check. And our fiscal note doesn't make any assumptions about that. The one assumption we can make is that we would not obtain less from tenant rents in our facility with a daycare in there than we would without them.
And that might be true, and yet when we talk about competition with the private sector, that certainly does create one. I know that in the Atwood, you have a private company running a restaurant, and I would be interested to know at some point if they're being charged half the fair market value to have that establishment. I think there's a coffee cart there also. I don't know if that's a separate entity or not. But that does raise some private sector competition issues. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, I believe they are charged an equivalent rate to the rest of but I will double check that and we'll get the answer. As far as the competition, though, this would not be a state-run operation. We would envision issuing an RFP and competing with private sector providers to come in and run the operations of a daycare, child care center. So we would compete in the open market for that.
No questions? Okay, thank you. Looks like we still got some outstanding issues with the committee. We're going to set the bill aside and hold it over for now. Okay, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Jones, for testifying, and Genevieve as well. Okay, let's now move on to the Forker Group. Their presentation will be on the State of Alaska Nonprofit Economy. As I'm sure committee members are aware, Alaska relies on nonprofit groups to provide a wide range of public services. As economic conditions in Alaska have tightened and the legislature has sought to constrain state spending, many of these organizations are struggling to meet public needs and accomplish their missions. Here to provide a brief overview of these challenges is Dennis McMillan, President and CEO of the Forker Group, well known to all of us, I'm sure. Dennis has devoted his professional career to helping nonprofit organizations better meet the needs of their communities. He came to Alaska in 1992 to lead the United Way of Anchorage. Since moving to Alaska, he has helped build the state's philanthropic infrastructure through his work with United Ways across the state and through his support in developing the Alaska Community Foundation. He's a strong advocate for Alaska's nonprofit sector. In 2001, Mr. McMillan led the effort to start the Forker Group with the mission of building sustainability and organizational capacity in Alaska's nonprofits. Welcome to Juneau, Mr. McMillan, and to the State Affairs Committee. If you could please come forward, put yourself on the record. Do we need to get you set up? Let's take a brief at ease while you get set up. you could put yourself on the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kathy Wasserman, the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League and also a board member of the 4-Acre Group. I just want to start out very quickly and briefly to talk about what the 4-Acre Group has done for my organization. I have 26 members on my board. It's much like herding cats. And I have to say that the 4-Acre Board has been instrumental in helping my board learn how to operate more effectively, in helping me, hopefully, to run the organization more effectively. We have taken just about all of the training that the 4-Acre Board makes possible to nonprofits around the state. But more importantly, the benefit that it leads to my organization is just one thing, but the overall benefit to the state is huge. And since the 4-Acre Group has been in existence, nonprofits that do a good job have become much, much stronger, and there are more nonprofits that do a very good job. And Dennis not only and his staff not only watch the organizations that are profitable, but help those that are not so profitable to either become so and more effective, or to become to merge with others. So it's not just something to build nonprofits across the state; it's to make those nonprofits that do exist more effective in the services that they provide. And I'm a huge fan of the 4-Acre Group. It's been a wonderful help, as I said, to my organization, and I've seen so many other organizations become much more effective than they were before due to 4-Acre. So, again, this is the president and CEO of 4-Acre Group, Dennis McMillan.
Thank you, Kathy. Dennis Walker.
So, for the record, I'm Dennis McMillan, the president of the 4-Acre Group, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it's good to see you. What I want to speak about today is something that I've been speaking about around the state for the past year, but we have really held off until now to address legislature about some of these findings and some of the issues that we're concerned with. And it's my hope that what I'm doing is building a constituency of you to help deliver this message on the floor as needed, because I am very sensitive to the fact that a very long, steady stream of nonprofit organizations show up on your door every year and ask for money for different things. And based on some research, we think that's going to probably escalate over the next few years. And so this is more of a heads up for the legislature about what we think is about to happen. What I'm going to present, first of all, is a study that was completed a little over a year ago by the Institute for Social and Economic Research at the university, ICER, on the nonprofit economy in Alaska. The 4-Acre Group does provide a lot of backroom and training support for nonprofits in Alaska, but we are also serving as the state's nonprofit association, so we're like the AML for nonprofits. And in that role, we're doing research periodically on a lot of different aspects of nonprofit effectiveness, and one of those is just the entire economy and what does it mean to the state of Alaska. We conducted and completed our first research in 2007. We did another one that was completed at the end of 2010. And we are on schedule to do those every 3 years, so we can start to develop baseline data and look at what's happening over time. So here's the first slide I want to show you is, first I want to show you data, and then I want to tell you what we think are going to be the trends. These are the official counts of not-for-profit organizations in Alaska, according to ICER. On the left, the ball that says 4,700 nonprofits is what the Internal Revenue Service says we have in Alaska. But those are the ones that are incorporated and in the state of Alaska. However, when we go to the state of Alaska and say how many not-for-profit corporations are incorporated in the state of Alaska, it's over 8,000. So we knew the 4,000 is not inclusive, and the 8,000, we noticed on that list of 8,000 that many of those organizations are probably inactive. So we asked ICER to guesstimate how many nonprofits there are in Alaska, and that's what this is. And I want to stop here to say, if you look at the ball on the left, it gives a pretty good breakdown of the percentages of different types of nonprofit organizations. So public charities and private foundations are the ones many people think of as not-for-profits. They're the charitable nonprofits, the ones that provide arts, social service, health in the community. Civic leagues would be organizations under the IRS code 501c4. Alaska Federation of Natives is one of the largest of those, but the CDQ groups operating in Western Alaska, many of them are 501c4s. Some of the economic development entities are 501c4s. And then we have member serving, which is another very large category of not-for-profits. That those are nonprofits like business associations, so chambers of commerce, but also credit unions. Also, a lot of our electrical utilities would be showing up in those numbers. So that gives you a little bit of a nonprofit 101 about where all these are. But in the number 4,700, when we looked at the detailed list of all the nonprofits there, we noticed that Providence Hospital didn't show up. Heart, Lung, Cancer, Diabetes did not show up, and that's because they're incorporated as headquartered in other places. We also know in the number of 4,700, statistically, only a third of religious congregations register with the Internal Revenue Service, meaning two-thirds do not. So there are 600 religious institutions at the 4,700 number, which means, according to ICER, that we probably have another 1,200 congregations in the state that are not registered, and churches are nonprofits. And up until 2011, nonprofits under the size of $25,000 a year in a budget did not have to register with IRS, and we knew there were 1,000 of those. So we have 7,000 nonprofits operating in Alaska is the best guess we have in the beginning of 2011. And I want you to hold that thought. The next one just shows about the expenditures to give you a sense of scale. It's a $4.5 billion industry. Almost three-quarters of that is 501c3 charitable nonprofits, and many, many, many health institutions in the state of Alaska are 501c3 nonprofits, and we're just representing how much of the charitable nonprofit sector is really influenced by healthcare, and it's a large, large chunk. Next slide is, again, looking at number, employment, and expenditures, and I think this is important only in that 9% of the organizations represent 61% of the employees and 60% of expenditures, and that's the health subsector of the not-for-profit sector. So, again, that's the part of the sector that drives a lot of this data. And then in the charitable sector, here are the 10 largest nonprofits in 501c3 nonprofits in Alaska. This is 2007 data, and I might note, because ICER suggests that I do this every time, that the federal government and most entities keep very bad data on the not-for-profit sector, and almost always, if you want to get good comparable data, it's 3 years old by the time you're using it. But this gives a pretty good list, and again, out of the 10 nonprofits that are the 10 largest, they're all health, and all but two are Native not-for-profits that are the largest, or three, excuse me, are Native not-for-profits. But this is the slide that is garnering a lot of attention, and with the disclaimer that the data that we have to make these assumptions is not good, but this is ICER's best guess on not so very good data. Just to notice at the orange and the green sections of these pies, and adding together, you can see that in Alaska we're getting 60% of our money coming in from the government into the not-for-profit sector. Nationally, it's 29%. There are many reasons for that discrepancy. One is that, as was already stated by the chair, there are many services provided in the state of Alaska by not-for-profit organizations that would be provided by the state and are provided by states throughout the country. And very early on, the state of Alaska has had the stand to fund nonprofits to provide a lot of these services instead of providing them directly. So that is one large reason. And then the other is the high proportion of Alaska Natives and the money coming in through BIA and IHS into the state of Alaska. But also, I'd like to note that if we look at the contributions in other slide or other pieces are the amount that are really the charitable giving to nonprofits. So nationally, it's 23%, and Alaska is 18%. We are below the national norm, but gaining on that statistic. But the private fees is another thing that's just to note that when we're talking about charitable nonprofits, half of their income nationally is raised through earned revenue, just like a for-profit corporation. Here is what's happened with just the Alaska pie since 2003. So since 2003, the government grants have dropped from 53% of the total to 43% of the total. And that's the trend that we see happening and we see continuing to happen over the next few years. Now, not in the ICER data, but from ICER data and other data, we know some other things about nonprofits in Alaska. My slide didn't work, so I'm not going to worry about it. But what that other slide really says is that we're disproportionately supported by foundations. We're disproportionately supported by corporations. Nationally, foundations represent 14% of total charity in America. And in Alaska, the Rasmussen Foundation by itself is 11.5% of total charity in Alaska. And when we add in all the other foundations that make gifts in Alaska, we're probably closer to 20% instead of 14% coming from foundations. Nationally, if you look at all corporate giving, it's only 5% of total philanthropy. But in our state, two companies represent 8% of total philanthropy, and that industry represents 11% of total philanthropy in Alaska. So we're, just like the state government, very dependent on one industry, overly dependent on one industry for charitable contributions. We are doing all we can to increase earned revenue in the nonprofit sector, as well as helping them determine new ways of raising money from individuals. And thanks to the legislative action a few years ago with Picklick Give, I'm happy to say that we're on target this year to probably hit $2 million of small gifts. I know we need to go.
No. Actually, you're good. I have a question though, because we do have legislation we've passed over the years that where if companies give a contribution for education, for instance, they get a large tax break.
Right.
Do you count if someone gives $1 million and they get a 50% tax credit? Do you count that as corporate, or do you count that as 50% government? Or I'm just curious.
Well, that would be. It's not. We wouldn't count as. That's all IRS data. So it's just the way the company represents that to IRS, and I wouldn't know how they do that on their taxes.
I was just curious for the, and that's probably maybe a question for ICER when they did their calculations. I wonder if that jacks the number up for government spending even more.
It might. It really might, because we do have that very generous provision for educational giving in Alaska, and I know many companies do take advantage of that. My assumption would be their total deduction is counted when they're giving that way. So here are the trends that we think are going to be impacting the sector and therefore impacting the steady stream of individuals that come to see you the next few years. There is going to be a funding crisis. It's inevitable. I think Alaska will always get a disproportionate amount of federal dollars because many, many different reasons coming in. But to think that we're going to keep at the same level that we've been at is naive. So we do think that there is going to be a drop. We're already seeing many nonprofits that for years have depended on earmarks from the federal government coming to us now and saying, well, that money's not coming anymore. What are we going to do? And we expect that to escalate. And we aren't sure how bad it's going to be, but what I think is going to happen is you're going to see many, many, many organizations coming here saying, if you don't give us money, we're going to go out of business tomorrow. And even though I'm here to represent the nonprofit sector and to support the nonprofit sector, I will urge you not to always be empathetic, but understand that a lot of these nonprofits have been listening to us for 11 years about this was going to happen, be prepared. And some have heeded the call and have been more prepared. And my own personal opinion is those that have heeded the call deserve the most support because they're the ones that have been trying to be proactive and make this happen. Also, the ones that are providing the critical services in the state of Alaska, I think, need to be considered. So we are expecting a funding crisis, but not related to the funding crisis. We're expecting, we're calling it the crash of the herd, but it's an overpopulation issue. If you stop for a minute and go back to the very first slide that says there's 7,000 nonprofits in Alaska, and that's the number that we're the most confident in as being accurate, 7,000. That's one nonprofit for every 100 Alaskans. But in order to serve legally on a board, you have to be 18 or over. So that's one nonprofit for every 72 people that might be able to serve on a board. However, not everybody that's an adult is a person that's going to be willing to serve on a nonprofit board. So we can use the people that are going to typically vote in a general election is a pretty good indicator. Those people are going to be more engaged in their community. So that would take it down to one nonprofit for every 34 people that might be a prospect to serve on a board. But there's another qualifier. Most individuals do not even think about serving on boards until they're 35 or 40. It's been that way forever. And after 65, you start to see declining interest in serving on boards. So when we really look at it, we probably have one nonprofit for every 28 to 30 people to find 10 or 12 good people to serve on a board. There are 80 million baby boomers in the United States. We don't know what the exact number is in Alaska, but 80 million nationally, and there are 44 million in Gen X. Every sector is preparing for what they are anticipating is a few lean years for human capacity when baby boomers retire and before the next generation, the millennial generation, ages up. That's going to be a major issue in the not-for-profit sector. If there's any one thing that we deal with more than anything else, it's helping nonprofits and their boards function better. It's helping nonprofits find board members, recruit board members, retain board members. So we don't think we have enough people, probably over the next decade, to actually serve on all the boards that there are. And that's going to be an issue. And on top of that, we're going to have the same problem that all industries are going to have in finding and retaining the right staff over the next 5 to 10 years. Quite frankly, we just don't think we have enough people in Alaska to maintain 7,000 nonprofits, which we think is the highest density of nonprofits in America, probably by far. And finally, the next trend we see happening, and this is to some extent as a result of funding and workforce shortages and volunteer shortages, but the whole world is restructuring, and we're watching it in the Arab Spring. We're watching it in a lot of different movements. We are quickly moving away from siloed, hierarchical institutions to networked institutions. Many different sectors have been writing about this phenomenon. It's accelerating. And it actually is coming at a good time, because what we really think is going to happen is we're going to see many, many different nonprofits partnering in new ways. The ones that are going to be sustainable are going to partner in new ways. They're going to find ways to integrate what they're doing. They're going to merge. We're going to see lots and lots of mergers, and it's where later this morning I will be meeting with a group of nonprofits here in Juneau that are all similar mission, and they're talking about merging. And we're doing that all over the state right now. So anticipate those things, because we think they are going to be the trends to watch. We're here to stand beside our nonprofits, but also you, because we're very dependent on the legislature. Tomorrow I'm going to speak to legislative staff on one caveat about funding and about capital campaigns that we also know from the research. But we're here to serve you and the state of Alaska, and so anything we can do to help you in addressing some of these trends that we see in the near future, please let us know. Thank you.
Dennis, thank you. Question from Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Dennis. Great presentation. You answered one of my questions, was that, you know, in the private sector, when times get tough, it forces companies to merge together, and it sounds like that's what's going on in the nonprofit sector as well. And I think that's good, because you mentioned there's 7,000 nonprofits. Well, maybe that's too many, but that's you know best on that. But tell me too, and you mentioned this, maybe I missed it. How do the nonprofits work with the religious groups?
You know, well, religious groups are nonprofits for the most part,
and
they are 501c3 if they want to be.
700.
Yeah, the 7,000 includes all the churches, synagogues, mosques in Alaska. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's the whole sector. 4-Acre Group works with the entire sector, so we work a lot with religious organizations and secular organizations throughout the state.
Okay. Well, and I'm glad to hear that, because I know one church runs the soup kitchen, and then a nonprofit runs the beans. And
right.
In Anchorage, we need them both, but you want to make sure
and actually they're working together. A great example that they have worked out who is doing what and how they're going to best meet the need of people. And that's what you want to see happening is in the private sector, competition is maybe benefiting the consumer. In the not-for-profit sector, competition and a lot of time gets in the way of effective help to people that need it. And so you want to see institutions that are by their very nature working together, finding solutions, not duplicating. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted. I should have been more polite.
Mm-hmm. No, that's okay. You asked us, too, what feedback we could give you. And one suggestion I would have is sometimes nonprofits come to the state for all of their capital needs. And the first thing I'll ask is, you know, who else is involved? You know, how much money are you raising on your own? Is the Rathmussen Foundation involved? Is ConocoPhillips involved? Most of the time, you know, they have had because I'm not the co-chair of finance anymore in charge of the capital budget, but that was often very frustrating to me, was that they would just rely on one source, the state of Alaska, for all of their capital needs. And what we want to leverage our money, the state's money, as much as possible as well. So that's why we prefer matching programs.
So through the chair, to be more appropriate, we have the presentation I'm doing tomorrow to this legislative staff is on that very issue, on capital campaigns. And because of the funding crisis, what do we think is going to happen? And we will have the Rasmussen Foundation and the Denali Commission and Conoco sitting at the table with us when we make this presentation. And the state is going to have to, in my opinion, have a different strategy around capital budgets in the future. And it has to do from what has been the art of raising money for capital projects, but now is the science. It's been economically tested and proven that if you do not have a significant lead gift on a major capital project, you will not have a successful campaign of raising the rest of the money. And you absolutely need to get money from lots of sources. But the rule of thumb that I've always known in the 30-plus years in the nonprofit sector is 50% from one donor of a capital project. And in the past, almost all the time, that was the federal government, it was Denali Commission, it was an earmark, it was something coming out. Sometimes it was the state, sometimes it was an oil company, sometimes it was Rasmussen, but most of the time it was the federal government. And Now, through some research, it was published in the not in the Economic Times publication. The actual sweet spot by science is 67% from one source for it to be successful, and that's what we're going to start sharing, because I think it really does provide some insight to the state about how it looks at capital projects and which ones are going to make it, and which ones are going to probably struggle.
If I may, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
Please.
I appreciate everything that the 4-Acre Group has been doing, Dennis, because one of the concerns, too, is that a lot of times these nonprofits are set up and run by people who have big, generous hearts and want to do good for the community, and but they have no business sense. And I think that's where 4-Acre has been a big help to these nonprofits, is to give them the accounting and business skills that maybe they're lacking. So appreciate your assistance.
Thank you. Dennis, do you have specific steps you believe the legislature should take to strengthen nonprofits and ensure their sustainability here in Alaska?
Yes. On the sheet of paper that I provided, first of all, I gave you this executive summary of the ICER report. But then on the sheet of paper, we have a very simple step of what we have been working on for a number of years, but it's a nonprofit sustainability guidelines. And by next fall, 4-Acre will publish a book on this issue, because we are certain there are four things that you can look at with a nonprofit to tell how sustainable that nonprofit is going to be. The first is, we call it focus, but it's a very clear understanding of who the nonprofit is, that the nonprofit is self-actualized, and that they know where they're headed. And it's very easy to assess that. If you see a nonprofit that's doing lots of different things that seems to be scattered, those institutions, just like any institutions, are going to have a harder time being effective. So organizations that really know why they were founded, what were the passions that caused that founding, and their singular purpose, are going to be more sustainable than those that try to do everything for everybody. But they also have to be strategic. It's thinking ahead. What is it that we need to be doing? When organizations come in and say, whoops, we weren't ready, that's a good indicator that they're probably not a very sustainable institution. The second piece of sustainability has to do with having the right people involved. And looking at the list of people that serve on the board, and having people that serve on the board assure you that they are active and that they are involved, is a critical step in you understanding whether that organization is going to be sustainable or not. There are many nonprofits that are very staff-driven, and this is not to take away from the dedicated people that work in nonprofits, most of whom work way below market and sacrifice. But the whole concept of a nonprofit is to have a board of trustees, of people that hold the fiduciary responsibilities for the organization, working in partnership with a staff, with a lead staff. So when you see a revolving door for executive directors coming in and out of the organization, that's not a very sustainable organization. If you don't see them with a sufficient number of board members that are willing to serve, that's probably not a very sustainable nonprofit. The third thing has to do with what I've already discussed. If they are not fluent in partnerships, if they are not fluent in collaboration, if they can't look at you and say, here are our partners, and this is how we work with our partners, and this is how we don't duplicate each other, that we support each other, those organizations are not sustainable. And finally, the term nonprofit is a misnomer, because nonprofits that are not generating a profit are not sustainable. Of course, profits in nonprofits don't go to the shareholders. They go back into the mission. But nonprofits really, as Senator Myers was saying, needs to operate in a business sense of generating unrestricted cash that they can use for flexibility and for meeting needs. And having a reserve account is a good thing for a nonprofit. And I know sometimes people will see, well, this organization has lots of money in the bank. Why would we want to give them more? There's probably some level of money in the bank that would be inappropriate, but for the most part, if they don't have money in the bank, they're not sustainable. They need to be generating a little bit more revenue than expense. A hand-to-mouth existence is a pretty good indicator of non-sustainability. So those are the four things.
Great, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none. Dennis, thank you again for coming to Juneau to meet with us. If you have any other recommendations or suggestions for the legislature, please feel free to forward them on to my office, and we'll pass them along. If there's nothing else coming before the committee, we are adjourned.